welcome back to the Mostly AI Smart Pod from the editors of AI Impact Smart Brief. I'm Susan Rush, and today with my co-hosts and fellow NotBots, I have Michael Domingo and Victoria Martinez with me. And today we're going to be talking about AI and third-party risk cyber management. You know, today, again, we're going to be tackling that massive paradox in the cybersecurity world. I'm really excited to talk to you all about it today. AI is moving at a breakneck speed, but so is the risk of vendors, suppliers, and third parties plugging into our networks. So today, I'm going to speak with Jeffrey Wheatman of Black Kite. But first, let's talk last week in AI.
All right, I'll start it off. Let's see. I had an honorable mention, and Victoria's going to cover this actually, because I forgot to compare notes. And my first honorable mention was actually the one on Ben Affleck, his company getting acquired. So I'll let Victoria cover that. It was an honorable mention, but there was a little side note that I kind of thought was interesting. Is that you went on in the TechCrunch article, there they talk about the Netflix commitment to Gen AI, and they, in a separate article in Variety that they linked to, they mentioned that Netflix already has about 300 projects that use generative AI, and I thought that was kind of interesting. So that's the side note. The big story for me last week is that is Meta committing to selling its excess compute capacity to Anthropic in a deal worth about $5 billion in a two-year deal. In short, basically, Meta's committing to becoming one of the major hypervisors. They're getting into the cloud business. And in fact, they announced Meta Compute about, maybe about 2 months ago, explaining their hyperscaler ambitions. And Meta, at the end of last year, they said they were building out their AI computing infrastructure. And it's like, what are they doing that for? And they're going to have a lot of excess computing power because of it, because, you know, they can't really use all the stuff that they were planning to use. So they plan to rent that out. Basically, any of the compute power and the APIs to third-party developers. As it stands, the major cloud computing companies rank this way. You're looking at Amazon, Microsoft, Google, Oracle, and IBM. And so with this deal with Anthropic, we'll soon see Meta, maybe. We'll see how that fares in the next couple of months. So for Anthropic and Meta to shake hands and show that Meta has real ambitions, that is going to be an interesting story in the next couple of months. And that's a wrap for me on the last week in AI.
Well, jumping in, I know that you mentioned Netflix. So Netflix finalized their $587 million acquisition of Interpositive. Interpositive is the AI filmmaking company founded by Ben Affleck. What I found really interesting about this is not only are they, the whole project is meant to boost production capabilities of Netflix, but they are bringing in the entire 16-person team from Interpositive, and they're going to be integrated into the Netflix team itself. So the point of this is, and they don't want people to think they're replacing, you know, creatives. This is basically the whole reason behind this is that they want to expand AI developing in filmmaking, but it'll be to create tools that, you know, will help to automate some features, not like, hey, let's just complete films made out of AI. So it's meant to be a really great asset for expanding capabilities of AI production in filmmaking, but it's not meant to take over. So I think it's really great. It'll be interesting to see how it plays into the offerings that Netflix has.
Yeah, I agree. I know everybody wants to talk about Netflix today. I thought that was, like, I was a little taken aback by Sarando's quote saying that they've already used it 300 times in post-production efforts. So, they're not thinking about getting into AI. They are in AI. So kind of segueing a little bit here, you know, one of the stats that we covered last week in AI Impact Smart Brief was that 29% of employees say they're sabotaging their company's AI strategy. You know, this was based on a writer and workplace intelligence survey. And interestingly, among Gen Z, that figure reaches up to 44%. So everybody's a little nervous. But Goldman Sachs, Elise Peng, she said, you know, this is not new. You know, in the early phase of technology, you know, disruption happens a lot faster than creation. So it makes sense that productivity gains are, you know, not supposed to be that prevalent, especially when, you know, the humans haven't caught up to the technology. So yeah, it makes sense that a lot of people, or at least almost 30%, are actively resisting this. Peng likened it to when the personal computer revolution hit. She said it actually took about 15 years for people to actually, you know, see those productivity gains. So, you know, there's still a lot of time for AI and those people to embrace what the technology has to offer.
I mean, just to add actually something to that, what this new, you know, acquisition, it's going to help them with post-production, mixing, relighting, and visual tools, which I think will be super great, because I despise when Netflix takes 1,000 years for the second season of something. And so I'm hoping that this will help. If it's helping with tasks like, you know, doing the remixing, that will help, you know, speed along and make it more a time crunch, it'll be great, because I really hate having to watch something and then rewatch the original season just so that I can catch up to what's happening on the second or third season, which I've had to do many times, but hopefully this helps.
You know, I do want to chime in on that. I'm watching House of Dragon right now, and it's like, how long did I have to wait for that? I have a feeling that that could have cut down post-production processing way back. And we would have probably seen it like in 6 months rather than 2 years. So for what it's worth, is AI the ultimate savior that will automate us out of this third-party risk nightmare? Or is it the villain making the attack surface infinitely more dangerous? Jeffrey Wheatman, cyber strategy icon and senior vice president at Black Kite, joined Susan to unpack this question in this interview.
Hi, Jeffrey. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Susan. It is so nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Great. Well, let's jump right in. So, you know, right now, AI is acting, or I guess, is it acting more as a villain, like empowering those bad guys, or a savior in third-party risk management? Maybe it's a little bit of both. What do you think?
Yes, I think it is both to a certain extent. You know, I think, you know, with a lot of the frontier models and a lot of the open models that are out there, it is giving the bad actors more of an opportunity. They're not necessarily doing anything different, but they're able to do the same stuff much, much faster. So that's the kind of villain side. But on the defense side, what we're hoping with models like Fable and Daybreak and all these frontier models, the software and hardware vendors will be able to do a better job putting out more secure product. So I think it's really helping both sides. The biggest challenge, though, for the defenders, I think, is that we typically have these long processes with all of these different approval requirements, and we still haven't really nailed down vulnerability management as a discipline. So I think that we need to do a better job on the defense side of automation, quicker discovery, and then really being able to do a quick down and dirty risk assessment and say, are we more exposed if we don't patch right away and test? Or are we more exposed if we just roll the patches out? And I think for most organizations, rolling the patches out is going to expose you significantly less than waiting and waiting and waiting. You know, one of the statistics we saw from the Mandiant report, the length between discovery of a vulnerability and it being announced is -7 days. That means the bad actors are leveraging these vulnerabilities and creating exploits, often using AI, before anyone even knows there's a problem. That is not a tenable long-term solution.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember being at RSA earlier this year and so many conversations about this, just how quick, but minus 7 days. Wow.
It's scary. And you know, the bad actors, they'll throw the stuff out there. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. They don't really care that much. But on the defense side, we don't have that same margin of error.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And, you know, kind of building on that, shadow IT is, you know, it's such a big topic right now. How do you see that changing the supply chain risk profile? And you know, are bad actors using AI to exploit these smaller vendors even faster than ever?
Yeah. So the smaller vendors or smaller companies are definitely a big target. At Black Kite, we actually just recently did a third party supply chain vulnerability management report. And then we also had a third party breach report. And what we're finding is the sweet spot is like $5 to $20 million in revenue. And the reason for that is those people will pay and they generally don't have a full budget to blow out a full security program. So there's definitely that challenge there. And I always say bad actors are like water. They flow downhill. They find the easiest way. Why am I going to try to break into a $50 billion company who has 500 people in their cyber team when I can just go into a company that doesn't even have a cyber team and get in the back door? And then as far as shadow IT and shadow AI, that is a long-term problem. We've heard a lot of talk about software bill of materials, SBOM. We've heard a lot of talk about AI bomb, AI bill of materials. And I think a lot of it really is we need to build a more collaborative environment where we're not pointing fingers and blame. Everyone needs to work together. The bad actors do it. On the defense side, we're not good at it. So, you know, send me your SBOM. Oh, you don't have one? All right, well, let's talk about what you can give us. You don't have an AI bomb? Okay, let's talk about what you can give us as opposed to just, you know, blaming. You know, we get a lot of our customers, for example, who are asking, you know, can we do SBOM? And we can. We can parse an SBOM and we can help you map that to your threat landscape in your ecosystem. But a lot of vendors are not providing them or they're not providing them updated. So they're old, they're dated. And with AI, those models are changing frequently, daily sometimes. So being able to keep up on that is a really, really big challenge. And we need to build these collaborative environments or the bad actors are just going to keep going after those smaller vendors who just can't afford to defend themselves at the level that we need to, even just helping them do basic blocking and tackling, you know, building communities where your vendors can talk to each other and work together and be able to understand that. And then, you know, being able to, you know, this company right here, they're a niche provider in financial services. They are deemed a critical provider. How can we help them help us? As opposed to, how can we blame them and wag fingers? Or if you don't fix what I want, I'm going to wag my finger very aggressively next time. And that's just not a long-term solution. It comes back to the first topic, which was about speed. If everybody's worried about getting in trouble, being blamed, they're not going to move as fast as they want because they got, we got to make sure it's got to be perfect. When I was in consulting earlier in my career, I had a project manager who said, like, you know, let's stop polishing the turd. Let's get it good, round enough to roll. And then, of course, the old adage, right? Enemy is the perfect, perfect is the enemy of good. And we need to get away from that.
Yeah. Do you see companies more willing to work collaboratively, or are they still sort of tiptoeing in the space?
We're definitely starting to see more collaboration. I think it still needs to really go up and out a little bit more. I think everybody's very concerned about themselves. I mean, humans are concerned about themselves. Companies are concerned about themselves. But we're definitely starting to see more collaboration. And we're really proud that we're building a community that does that. We're doing a roadshow. We host a bunch of dinners where nobody from sales and marketing comes. It's me facilitating conversations. And I think that's really where the collaboration comes from, where people are willing to expose their warts, open the raincoat without worrying that they're going to go back in and go, oh, you know what I heard Bob or Mary say at this thing? They're not doing this. So it's getting better. And I think as we start to see more success, it'll start to accelerate. you know, people are still a little bit fearful, but I think we're definitely moving in the right direction, slowly but surely. And some of the regulatory environment out there is pushing that. In the EU, we're seeing, you know, NIS2 and DORA for financial services. You know, in the US, we're seeing more stuff around NIST, and then ISO globally starting to talk more about third-party management, supply chain management. And it's going to force people to work together in a more effective way than we have historically seen.
Yeah, that's great news, and I hope it continues. It is exciting to hear those positive things.
Yep.
You know, when a vendor or company, you know, mishandles data, you know, via AI or causes an AI-driven breach, you know, who ultimately holds that, you know, let's say, you know, hot potato of legal or regulatory liability?
That is the concept of what we call downstream liability. And at the end of the day, what we have largely seen in the courts is you collected the data, you are responsible for it. We're not interested in hearing, well, it wasn't us, it was them. That's one thing. But the other thing, data loss is certainly something we need to look at, but we've seen a huge shift toward resilience. How do we keep the business up and running? Everyone recognizes the data is going to get breached. There's no way we're ever going to fix that problem 100%. But the business operational resilience, what vendors are going to have an impact on us, our ability to deliver products and services for which we are paid. So we're starting to see a lot of contractual compliance things. And again, you're responsible for your stuff. And that means we need to do a better job of, you know, where are our risks? Where is our data? Where are our critical operational dependencies? And in some cases, there may not be a backup plan. There may not be an alternative. And then we need to figure out, and that's really through communication, letting our executives know, hey, by the way, if this vendor goes down, we're in a lot of trouble. We're not going to be able to function. And by the way, they're not good at cyber. How do we fix that? How do we work on that? How do we fall back? You know, my wife and I are watching season 2 of The Pitt on streaming, and I'm going to ruin it because it's not new anymore, but there's a cyber incident and they have to fall back to manual process, and the frustration for the younger folks going, what do you mean there's no computer, right? Sometimes there is no fallback, and then it's just about communication and say, look, we're going to have exposure here. We just need to deal with it. So I think that's really, you know, what the case is there. But, you know, the short answer to your question is you are responsible for your own operational resilience. You are responsible for data that you collect.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating just to think about that a little bit more. You know, and it's not only, you know, like, let's say at the IT level, who's responsible, but, you know, as it moves down the chain at a company, people using the AI need to realize their responsibility in it as well. And yep. I think a lot of times people don't think that way, but, you know, it's like, oh, well, IT gave me this or said I could use this. But yeah, taking that accountability way down the chain at every company, I think is going to be important.
And,
as well.
And, you know, your point's very interesting there, because what we're seeing is a lot of the AI stuff is really very deeply embedded. You know, if you know the old story from Bertrand Russell, right, it's turtles all the way down. And we are then making business decision based on logic that we don't necessarily understand. You know, the one thing everyone needs to know, generative AI is non-deterministic, meaning you can give it the exact same inputs with the same prompt and you're going to get different answers sometimes. Well, people are making business decisions based upon that. So we need to start asking better questions. Where are you using AI? How is it helping? What decisions are being made? Where's the human in the loop to give it a gut check? Oh, that doesn't sound right. Maybe we should start asking some questions. And I think that's, you know, a big challenge, and it's a governance problem.
Yeah, it kind of leans into kind of where I want to go next. You know, companies say they're AI powered. You know, how can those CISOs separate, you know, this marketing fluff from actual AI risk management?
It's funny you mentioned that, and you were at RSA. This was a problem I saw at RSA. I thought 80% of the vendors were doing something around AI. About half of them were using AI to solve security, and half of them were using security to solve AI. I don't think really any of them are sort of doing that. But, you know, it comes down to, just because you can throw AI at a problem doesn't mean you should. That's not always the best solution. I was talking to a buddy of mine. He spent 18 hours creating an agent to solve a problem that took him 3 minutes to do, right? So he spent all that time creating an agent to do something to save himself 3 minutes. If you do the math, you'd have to do that thing 50 times a week to make it worthwhile. And that's the thing. And I think there are three questions you should ask vendors when they say they use AI. And this is true of security and regular. What do you do that you couldn't do before with AI? What do you do better with AI? And what do you do that your competitors can't do using AI? And if your vendor can't at least answer one of those questions in a way that makes you comfortable, you need to start asking deeper probing questions. And I think that's really that challenge. And then the other thing, and we're very proud of this at Black Kite, AI is the core of our offering. Rather than, okay, where can we slap AI on? So, right, it's AI from the ground up as opposed to slapping it on. And I think those are some questions that we need to start asking. And I think a lot of companies are, you know, throwing AI because if they don't, they get dinged in the market. We're seeing it in the investment market as well as in the buying market. Oh, you're using AI? No. Oh, well, we're going to move on now. And that's, yeah, I think, a big mistake.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. You know, kind of just pulling it back to the villain versus savior idea, you know, kind of looking ahead, you know, where does, let's say, you know, the savior, you know, pull ahead? Is it possible, or are the villains always going to be one step ahead of us?
Well, the villains have always been one step ahead of us. I think they're going to continue to stay ahead of us, largely because they don't care if their attacks fail. They're just going to try it over and over and over again. I do think we need to look for opportunities to close that gap, both from a technical capability as well as from a timing perspective. But I'm a big fan of Sun Tzu, The Art of War. We are at war and we're losing. And a big chunk of it, which we talked about earlier, is the lack of collaboration. And I think if we can expand that collaboration, I think that will go a long way toward closing that down. And then the second part of that, we need to be more honest and say, look, we're, no matter how much money you give us, no matter how many people you give us, we're never going to be 100% secure. Yeah. And we have to work from that as a premise. And I don't think we've done a good job there. I mean, the vast majority of what I do is I help security people communicate with business executives to take these technical things and turn them into business context, right? Business executives care about three things: money coming in, money going out, and if something goes bad, who's in trouble? And that's it. It's a dramatic oversimplification, but we need to start thinking more about that, right? We can't go to our executives and say, give me money or something bad is going to happen. You need to go to them and say, we need to address this problem, or this critical system that you can't do without is going to be breached. It's going to fall over. If you're okay with that, I'm okay with that. Are you? And most of the time they say, no, what do you want to do about it? And then we have a negotiation and, back and forth, asymmetrical communication pathway, always talking about money, 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 and risk. And I think that's the answer to the question, really.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to bring our conversation to a close. You really summed it up there. Any other key takeaways we missed here, or do you think we got it?
I mean, I think we covered it, but what I always tell people to do is you need to implement proper governance. I know it's the G word, right? But we have to have better governance, and we need to actually implement the governance with tools and controls. Start simple. And as you nail that and get good with it, you can start expanding and blowing it out. But just saying you have AI governance, risk governance is not enough. You actually have to do it, right? We can talk about it all we want, but if you don't act, it's just words and paper.
Yeah, no.
So great. That's what it's I would kind of close to, with.
Great way to bring it. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Susan, it's my pleasure.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll have you back on because there's a lot more we could talk about.
Absolutely. I would love to come anytime you want. Cheers, everyone.
Thanks.
All right. That interview was pretty informative. And Vicky, you want to start off with some thoughts on it, right?
Yeah, I actually wrote something down. One of the things that, you know, my key takeaways was that AI, what it does, it allows for the donateurs, it allows bad actors to have more attacks. But at the same time, you can have defenders who will have the potential to improve any software or hardware that will help defend against these attacks. So it's interesting, the balance there.
Yeah, you know, one thing Jeffrey said, you know, the villains are always one step ahead. But then he went on to say, you know, he's a big fan of Sun Tzu, you know, the art of war. You know, he said, you know, we're never going to be 100% secure. But he thinks that, you know, we have to work, you know, to make sure that we are combating the villains. And, you know, one of the things, how we do that, collaboration across the company. You know, security people really need to be communicating with those business executives, translating these technical topics into real business context. I think that's how we win the war.
All right. I did have a few takeaways from this interview. And one is my first one that, and I like that whole idea of the villains versus savior. Villains don't care if their attacks fail, right? I hadn't really thought about that. And it's the reverse of a risk where you don't even care about the risk of failure, you know, especially when you're the villain, because all you do is you basically keep, you know, failing until it actually works. And those attacks, you know, that's, they scare, they'll scare your, whoever you are, you're trying to attack. And, you know, eventually something will get through and you just keep pounding and pounding away and basically go, you know, attack at another angle until it works. And so on and so on. Eventually, on the receiving end, you're just basically going like, oh my goodness, there's so many attacks going on. Even the ones that don't work, you know, they're trying to get in. Eventually, they, you know, they might. So AI kind of has to be our savior on that end, right? You know, they have to be at the deflector shields because we can't scramble fast enough to protect ourselves. So that's the kind of like the villain versus a savior end of it. But then. The second point is Wheatman talked about the issue of infinite regression when he mentioned the phrase turtles all the way down. I kind of remember that one from Philosophy 101. And I was like, if something finally like from my Philosophy 101 class made it into my work day. And I was like, oh, great. You know, somebody must have told me that sometime in my past that was going to be a phrase. I'm going to, you know, like remember this one. And I was like, it's philosophy. Then that doesn't apply to real work or real life. So anyways, Jeffrey said in the interview that turtles all the way down sums up the view of companies using AI without basis for its use. There's no need. There needs to be a justification or a foundation upon which you ask the right questions for implementing AI tools or developing an AI strategy or using AI for AI's sake, you know, for AI's sake. Companies will look for solutions where no problem exists and they can hope a problem eventually develops into something real. And that's coming at the issue backwards. So for what it's worth, every press release I see that mentions AI, it's as if every company is working on a foundation where it's turtles all the way down, so to speak. And that's kind of where I'm seeing it right now. So,
you know, actually something that I wanted to add when you're saying, you know, the saviors and villains, I know I'm going to date myself in this, but it just makes me think, do you remember the movie Hackers? I mean, I love that movie. It's like one of the best movies ever. And just at the end of the scene, I'm like thinking at the end where like they're all like having all the hackers are uniting from around the world to attack this one global conglomerate. And I think that's what I picture in my brain when I hear villains and saviors.
Interesting. You know, I have a little history on that movie, but I'm not gonna bore you with that stupid story. It has to do with my last company that I worked for and how the production company actually asked for copies of our magazine to put on the desks, and you actually see them in the thing. So anyways, all right, Vicky with the 2-minute tech pulse, she's up next.
All right, so this week it's actually two good ones. Anthropic debuted Claude for Teachers, and it's supposed to streamline their lesson planning. It'll help with personalizing materials and improve instructions. It's going to be available for free to all teachers within the U.S. for educators in the U.S., but it's currently being piloted in the Detroit public school system. One of the things that they did emphasize was that they are working very strictly to adhere to privacy and safety, and that the teachers, none of the conversations will be used for any AI training. So that's really good. Next up on our Tech Pulse, AXAI released automations for Grok, which is basically, first of all, I've never used the Grok AI, so I've never used it outside of the X platform, but this seems interesting. It's basically a feature that lets their users automate their tasks by describing them, and then once they have all been set up. They can be scheduled and triggered at a later point. It basically says that it's for users to create, pause, edit any type of automations through their web or mobile app. So it's supposed to streamline workflows. No, we'll see how it works. Again, I've actually never used the standalone Grok AI outside of the X platform. So it'll be interesting to see. But that's today's Tech Pulse.
Yeah. Anything I think that can help teachers streamline their day so they can spend more time teaching in the classroom without so much work outside the classroom, I think is great. Some of those teachers might be in that 29%. That's not so, it might be a higher percentage in education who don't want to embrace AI. But yeah, definitely something to watch.
Well, I do know from obviously my son, I know that a lot of programs are shifting. Like, so there's like the Khan Academy and there's, I know in Florida, we have the Miami-Dade app. So everything is online. So I know that teachers are already accustomed to focusing their efforts onto any, everything is online. And hopefully this will just be one more added tool that they use because they do have, I think Classroom is something that from Google, it's also meant to help. Maybe this will just make their job even more simple.
Yeah. AI.
All I know is I wish I was going to school right now with all the AI tools that are available.
I don't know. Would you get in trouble in school, Domingo? I'm not sure.
I sounded smart.
We'll leave it at that. We'll leave that to the imagination. Yeah. But anyway, that's our show for today. If you like this podcast, please, of course, share with your friends and colleagues. You can follow us on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget, please subscribe to AI Impact Smart Brief. Thanks. Have a great day.
The Mostly AI podcast is a production of Smart Brief, a future company.